show, the man says. And boom, the music starts.
Music.
It's like a well-oiled machine. Hey, everybody, it's Kai. Welcome back to Make Me Smart. It is Tuesday. Today, the deep dive show, the big show into one topic on which an expert makes me and Kimberly and hopefully all y'all smart. Today, we're doing our elections. We've been talking about this in our meetings for quite a while, how we're going to go about it, how secure they are or perhaps not, and what's going to happen in November. So that's what we're going to do.
Yeah, so there are a couple reasons that we want to do this show. First of all, as during the primaries, there were a number of issues that cropped up. We had electronic voting machines that broke down in places like Georgia, resulting in huge lines if people did want to go and vote. In Wisconsin and in other states, people had to choose between risking their lives in a pandemic, basically, to go and vote in person or sending in a mail-in ballot. A lot of people are very skeptical of those at this particular juncture. And all around the country, we did see mail-in ballots arriving late or sometimes not being counted.
And as we know, because of the pandemic, mail-in voting is going to be a bigger thing this fall than it's been probably ever, which puts pressure on the post office, which is in the news for reasons of its own, which we'll get to here in a little bit. So lots of questions about this year's elections, how they're going to work, and the security thereof. So we've gotten Michael Alvarez on the phone. He's a professor at Caltech, also the co-director of the Caltech MIT Voting Technology Project. Michael, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Let me start with a super broad question, and then we can riff from there. As a voting member of the American public, how confident are you in the security of this fall's elections?
In the security of the election, I'm reasonably confident. I think that our election officials have been working really hard over the last few months, and they're going to continue to do that over the next 80-plus days to make sure that this process goes smoothly and seamlessly and securely. I'm a lot more worried about the kind of snafus that you already talked about, just the logistical problems of getting these ballots out by mail, how long it's going to take to count them and tabulate them, when the results are going to be released, and how impatient people are going to inevitably be to learn the results, not just of the presidential election, but of Senate, gubernatorial, and House elections throughout the country. So, you know, again, I'm just a lot more worried about the logistical problems. I'm worried about voters not getting their ballots. I'm worried about voters who may make mistakes on their ballots and therefore end up with tabulation mistakes.
So then if you're not so worried about sort of the security, which brings to mind things like hacking and, you know, whether or not there's going to be fraud, of which we've seen very little in our elections, how confident are you that everybody who wants to vote is actually going to be able to vote and have that vote counted?
Well, again, that's, I think, going to be the big problem that we're going to run into this fall. I'll just say, I'm not, security is a huge problem, and we need to make sure that the process is secure. But in terms of just when you think about the scale of what's likely to go wrong this fall, the problems that we were just talking about, you know, are much more likely to occur. And I do think that voters in this election are going to need to be much more vigilant on a personal level about exercising their franchise than they may ever have been needed to be in the past. And I encourage voters at this point, if you're in a state where you can check to make sure that your registration status is valid, the address is correct, do so now. Do so today. Do so this week. Don't wait until the last minute to check the veracity of that information. Because, you know, again, if you're relying on getting your ballot by mail, you know, make sure that information is correct so that they're sending the ballot to the right address. So there's lots of little things like that I think voters can do to make sure that they get the ballot and that they mark it correctly and they sign it correctly. You know, follow those directions carefully. Scan your ballot to make sure you're not making, you know, silly mistakes like overvoting or skipping races. You know, take a lot of care. Your franchise is incredibly important. And again, as voters, I do think this is an election where we have to be vigilant and make sure that everything goes as well as it can go from our point of view.
You know, it's funny. So first of all, I did actually this past weekend on the advice of a friend check my voting registration status here in the state of California. Super easy. You go to the Secretary of State's website and you can do it. And I do recommend it for everybody. And thankfully, my registration is valid and entered. So that's good. But it occurs to me this thing you just said about we have to take care with our franchise this year. We have gotten, and all right, look, one guy's opinion, but here you go. It seems to me we have gotten lazy with our right to vote, and we just kind of expect it to be there and not be difficult, you know, and that's going to be a challenge this year.
Well, you know, it's like anything else in I think, current society. We expect things to be convenient. We expect them to be easy, and we expect that, you know, technology is going to help us out a lot. Well, you know what? This is going to be an election where that may not be the case. A lot of voters now, because of the Help America Vote Act that was passed, almost two decades ago, when they go in to vote in person, they can use voting technology that helps them correct their ballot for simple mistakes. Unfortunately, in this election, again, if you're voting by mail, you're not going to have the opportunity to take advantage of that kind of technology. So this is, again, one of those elections where we just have to be vigilant. And our franchise is important. This is going to be a very important election in our lifetimes. And so, again, I'm encouraging everyone to really take the steps necessary to make sure that your information is accurate and you're casting your ballot correctly and that you sign the back of the envelope or take whatever steps are required to make sure that that ballot is received and counted as you intended.
So we're talking a lot about mail-in voting being the default for a lot of people in this election. And given that we seem to not be able to control this pandemic at all, that will be the safe option for so many people. But how widely available is sort of mail-in voting / absentee voting / vote by mail, whatever you want to call it, since they're all basically the same?
Well, as luck would have it for me, the New York Times today released a study and a new report that has some of the most up-to-date information on this. And again, one thing to keep in mind is that in every state, you can vote by mail. The question is, how easy is it going to be for you to get that ballot and vote it by mail? Nine states, including the District of Columbia, are like California, which Kai just talked about, where we're going to get a ballot. Every registered voter will receive a ballot in the mail.
A ballot or an application for a ballot?
A ballot. In those nine states, they are going to get a ballot in the mail before the election. Now, in 33 other states, they'll have some form of no-excuse absentee voting. In eight of those states, all registered voters are going to get a vote-by-mail application, which is what you just mentioned. 25 of those 33 states, registered voters are going to need to get the application themselves. So they have to go track it down, they have to fill it out, and they have to send it in. Eight states, voters are going to have some form of non-COVID-related excuse to get a vote-by-mail ballot. So the voters who are going to have the most difficulty casting a by-mail ballot are going to be voters in those eight states, which include New York, South Carolina, Indiana, Kentucky, Tennessee, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Texas.
Seems to me then Kimberly's question from a moment or two ago is really relevant, right? It's the disenfranchisement that will be easier to facilitate, I suppose, or to engineer, that is a greater threat this time around.
Exactly. And I think that, in these states where it's going to be difficult for voters, in the states where voters are going to have to track down the absentee ballot and send it in themselves, or they're not going to be able to get a vote-by-mail ballot because they really need some excuse that's not COVID-related, those are going to be the states where I think people are going to have the most difficulty voting. They're pretty much going to have to go and vote in person. That's going to be a situation where those options are going to be limited. I think in many of these places, people may not want to go stand in line to vote. And I do think those are going to be the places where we're going to be watching very carefully in November to just see how the process unfolds as people try to exercise their franchise.
Who is we?
The Caltech MIT Voting Technology Project in particular. We've been in this business for almost two decades now. We were formed in the aftermath of the 2000 presidential election. And there's a group of us at Caltech and a group at MIT, plus a large number of other academics throughout the country who we're closely affiliated with, who are all going to be studying different aspects of the electoral process this fall.
I guess I was asking because I'm wondering if there's going to be like anybody kind of watching in a way to help if there is disenfranchisement, or watching
intervene. Carter Center election monitors, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I'm sure that there will be those kind of efforts. I mean, those kind of efforts always spring up. There are lots of stakeholders who are going to be involved in the process, like there always is in any contested election. I'm sure those operations will continue, and they're just going to be different operations than they've been in the past. From our perspective, we do a similar kind of service, but it's really aimed more at our academic research. At Caltech, we do have a project that we're calling Monitoring the Election. And we've been doing this project. It's focused on California. It's focused on Southern California in particular, where we actually do send people out to watch the polling process as it unfolds in vote centers and precincts, where we try to monitor all the data streams we can get access to in near real time to try to see if people are reporting problems on social media, or see if in other data flows that we can get from the election officials, we're finding anomalies that are indicative of administrative problems or other kinds of issues. We put all that on a website, and then we ultimately will write a report about the counties that we closely monitor. And that's going to cover mainly Southern California this fall, just because that's the scale at which we can do it in my research group.
You mentioned the 2000 election as when your group started. And then earlier in the conversation, you had talked about us getting used to the idea that there's not going to be an election night, as it were, in this election. What's your guess, given the mail-in ballots and all the complications around this election? If you had to spitball it, when are we going to know who won this thing?
Okay, now, you know, that's a surprisingly complicated question, and I'll do my best to answer.
I'm not surprised at all that it's complicated. I'm totally not surprised.
It's a complicated question. Now, let's just focus for a second on the presidential level. Okay, so at the presidential level, in many states, I suspect that, you know, on election night or late, early in the morning, the following morning, we may know the outcome of the presidential race. My guess is that there will be a handful of states where we might wait a day or two because of late arriving vote by mail ballots, and in competitive states where you know, battleground states where the election is very close. So whether that's going to matter in terms of the allocation of electoral college votes is really hard to foresee at this point. But I would not be surprised if you know, those of us who are watching this election closely, like the 2000 presidential election, are up until very late the day after the election or on into the following days, where we may just not know. Now the other complexity here, though, is that I think that this problem, not knowing the outcome of the election, is going to be particularly prevalent in congressional races. Again, these are races, there's going to be many, many competitive congressional races. They're going to be very close. There are many fewer ballots that are going to be cast. Many of these races are going to be in states that are going to have either entirely universal vote-by-mail voting, or many, many voters are going to be voting by mail. So when it comes to the U.S. House of Representatives, we may not know for weeks who controls the House of Representatives.
Wow.
The other phenomenon here that I just wanted to highlight, because again, like I said, this is a complicated one, and we could talk for hours about it, is what I and some of my other colleagues, Charles Stewart and Ned Foley at Ohio State, have been calling the blue shift. One of the things that we've observed systematically in elections in the last couple of years is that late arriving ballots, those ballots that are counted after the election day, well on into maybe the next few days or the next weeks, those ballots tend to be from Democratic voters. And so what we've been seeing in close elections in the last couple of cycles is that maybe on election night, congressional districts like here in Southern California, they may be trending Republican at that point. But over the next couple of days, those vote margins will inevitably and steadily shift towards Democrats. That blue shift has been the cause of some consternation. People see that and they think, hey, that's got to be fraud. But it's not. It's an inevitable consequence of the fact that we're going to have many, many, many ballots that are going to be arriving late and being added to the tabulation late. And those ballots typically come from Democratic voters.
Do we know why those late ballots tend to come from blue areas?
Well, they tend to come from Democratic-leaning voters. You know, again, historically, what we've seen is that, you know, Republican voters tend to get their votes in early. They tend to cast their votes by mail. They tend to vote early, or they come in on election day and vote on election day. And in many places, Democratic voters are ones who send in their ballot late. They drop their ballot off on election day, or they're, because of various reasons, they're forced to vote provisionally. And so those are the ballots that are authenticated and tabulated days after the election.
Fascinating.
I see. So speaking of ballots arriving late, how much does all of this drama at the United States Postal Service, how much is all of this going to play into it? We've had a leadership change, a bunch of changes to the way the place operates, that, you know, reducing overtime and potentially even more changes down the pipeline that a lot of people are really concerned is going to have a major effect on the election. How worried are you about that?
Incredibly concerned. I'm sure you've all experienced over the last couple of weeks what seem to be significant delays in the delivery of mail. I'm hearing about it from my friends and you know, my students. We were on a call yesterday where they were talking about how mail service seems to be slower than it's been in the past. You know, the volume of ballots that are going to be in the mail system at a very short period of time is going to put an enormous amount of strain on the U.S. Postal Service. We're talking about tens of millions of ballots in many states. And I think that, you know, the Postal Service is going to have to step up and really make sure that those ballots get delivered in a timely manner to voters. Voters are going to have to step up, like we talked about earlier, and be very vigilant to make sure that they get their ballot. But then I think voters are going to have to be very cautious about how they return their ballots. If you live in a state where you can go and drop your ballot off at a drop box before the election that's controlled by the county election officials, I would encourage people to do that. I mean, that's the best way to ensure that your ballot does not get delayed by the U.S. Postal Service.
Michael Alvarez is a professor at Caltech, also the co-director of the Caltech MIT Voting Technology Project. Lots of good stuff in there, most of which is vote early, 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 and make sure you protect your franchise. Holy cow. Michael, thanks a lot.
Yeah,
I really appreciate
it. Sure.
Thanks for having me.
That blue voters thing being late is just fascinating.
Fascinating.
You know?
I'm going to look for more on that. I'm very curious as to
sort of
the nuances of that.
Totally fascinating. Also, do check out your voter registration, by the way. It's so easy to do, and you don't want to show up on election day or have your ballot deemed a provisional because your registration is messed up. That would just wreck your whole day.
And even if it isn't easy to do in your particular state, again, protecting your franchise, you know, do the work and I guess do the best you can to try to find out, even if it means calling people.
Yeah, do that. Okay, we're going to take a break. Send us your comments, though, on what we're talking about today or anything, frankly, that you hear on this podcast. Email or voice memo, as you know, makemesmart@marketplace.org. Back in a flash.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Okay, so now, ready for the news fix.
We are.
And Kai, you know that I have capital F feelings about cruises because... I, as you know, went on a cruise just before the worst of the pandemic kind of settled in, and I was worried. But thankfully, you know, my family was safe. I hope everyone else was safe. However, I was looking at CNBC today and saw that the Royal Caribbean stock has jumped, you know, in there. Because the executives are like, oh, yeah, tons of people are booking cruises for 2021, which kind of makes sense because everybody's stuck in the house.
No, it doesn't. Sorry. Did I say that out loud? Sorry.
You said it out loud. So,
although I will tell you.
You know, people are stuck at home fantasizing about their next vacation. Let me tell you that my family is planning a cruise in 2021. And I was very much being made to feel like a non-team player if I didn't want to go because they were just like, it's fully refundable and it's so far in advance and we can see what the pandemic is going to do. And so I was like, oh my gosh, are we really doing this again? But my family, classic example, cruise bookings doing very well for 2021. And so as terrible as the financial straits of these cruise lines are at this particular moment, it's looking good for 2021. So I know this is supposed to be the one article thing, but I have to do the follow-up,
which is this Wall Street Journal article,
which is talking about the fact that perhaps after I got off that cruise ship and the staff was turning it around for the next cruise in February, some of those staff members were stuck on those boats for months.
Yeah,
months,
like thousands of people.
Yes. Yes, stuck on those boats for months trying to get home because they come from all over the world. There's various lockdowns, various procedures. The cruise companies maybe weren't willing to pay to send them one place or the other. It's a crazy story.
Yeah, it's bananas. Now I should come clean here. And clearly I'm biased against cruises, number one, because the pandemic. But number two, I swore after my umpteenth straight day at sea on the Theodore Roosevelt back when I was in the service – that I would never pay anybody to take me out on the ocean. So that's where I'm coming from.
Very fair. Just,
you know, full disclosure.
But look,
I understand the I want to get away thing and holy cow, I need something. But I don't know if I would do that.
So look, are you going to go?
Are you going to go?
I am signed up to go.
Yes. Well, send us a postcard.
You know, all my nieces and nephews are going to be going, and it's rare that we can all get together in one place. But again, it depends on the pandemic, because I will be very quick to be like, you know what, not going to happen if cases are fill in the blank. But then I'll be the bad auntie.
Somebody has to be. All right. Yeah. So mine is less chuckle worthy, but. No less serious
what
than the pandemic.
What is chuckle
worthy? Well, I don't know. I mean, it's chuckle worthy that, you know, you're going to go and have a time with your nieces and nephews. That'd be fun. An article in Bloomberg today pointing out something which you and I have talked about a little bit before when you've been in. And it's the number of small businesses going broke in this pandemic. And there are tens of thousands of them. But the point of this Bloomberg piece, according to some data from the National Federation for Independent Businesses, is that many of them are uncounted. And so we don't actually know what we don't know about how bad this pandemic is going to be. And the reason that matters is because small businesses in this economy account for a huge proportion of jobs. Companies with less than 500 employees account for something like 44% of all jobs. So if the small ones are going out of business and we're not noticing, I'm here to tell you that when this pandemic finally ends and we look around at the economy, it's going to look different in no small part because of this. And we all just need to be aware of that and understand what it means when businesses die, jobs die permanently, they go away. And that, to quote Jay Powell yet again on this podcast, is lasting damage to the economy. And that's just real. So.
Yeah, and this is happening at a much higher rate for Black-owned businesses based on the limited data that I've seen, and I'm sure for other minority-owned businesses. And one of the things that's been really fascinating to me covering this is that so many minority-owned businesses are sole proprietorships, right? It's one person who's a consultant or a contractor or something like that. And so when their work dries up and – whatever, it's just that one job, but that one job of scale so high, that one job at scale, I guess, is what we're seeing. And I heard something really interesting when I was listening to some congressional testimony, because I'm a cool kid and that's what I do.
You need to get out more, pal. Holy cow. What do you do for fun, Kimberly? Well, I listen to congressional testimony. Anyway, go ahead.
It's like that scene from Seinfeld. What do you do for fun? I'm watching Canadian C-SPAN that. But it was all of these – they were talking about sort of the effect of COVID on minority-owned businesses, right? And there was a gentleman on from the Black Chamber of Commerce, which represents Black Chambers of Commerce all over the country. And he was saying one of the things that needs to happen is that – the federal government should allow some of the relief funds to go towards businesses purchasing businesses that are going out of business, which I thought was super fascinating, this idea that, especially for Black-owned businesses, he was saying if you allow people to use, say, a PPP loan to purchase five other accounting consultants that were sole proprietorships integrate them into one and make them merge them into one, that might save some Black-owned businesses. You know, it was something I hadn't heard before. I thought it was super fascinating.
Yeah, totally interesting. Totally interesting. But the small business thing is a mess. It's going to have big follow on. Okay, so that's us. Now we go to you.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
All right, so keeping on the theme today.
Yes.
What?
That's my favorite sting ever. I love that one. All those voices.
They are really nice. Mm. All right. So I'll start with a letter from listener Ned Fitzgerald in Everett, Washington, on the subject of mail-in voting. Ned writes, I've been voting through the mail since I graduated from college in Oregon and later here in the state of Washington. To my knowledge, I haven't missed an election, but I did have an issue in the recent Washington state primary where ballots were mailed on July the 8th. Mine never came. Here in Washington, the state sends me a text message when ballots are mailed. If I didn't receive my ballot, I can request a replacement ballot online. In my case, the second ballot arrived without incident and I posted my ballot the next day. I did not use the mail to return my ballot and won't be doing so in the general election this fall. In this state, and also in Oregon and Colorado, we have ballot drop boxes where we can put our completed ballots. Within one day of putting my ballot in the drop box, the website noted that my ballot had been received and accepted. On the evening of the election, the website updates to show my ballot was counted. Vote by mail can be done safely, and in the past, I never had any issues with it. Personally, I'd love to see more states adopt the process. It's totally fair, and it works.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the Dropbox thing is totally interesting. That's a new-to-me phenomenon, although I guess some states have been doing it for a while, but I think it's a really interesting idea and takes care of a lot of issues, frankly. Oren Collier wrote in to say this. First, as always, I love the show. I also want to give a big shout-out to Kimberly Adams. Love when you are on the show. So there you go.
Thank you.
The perspective you bring and your thoughtful commentary are so refreshing. You and Molly have made me cry a little, laugh a little, think a little, and learn a little. So how can I ask for more than that? Now down to business. Alpacas, definitely. Which I guess you guys talked about last week while I was gone. Alpacas?
Yes, a lot.
Okay. All right. Okay. Also, thank you for bringing up A League of Their Own. I'm going with it. Thank you for bringing up A League of Their Own. It was a really good movie, but until we are able to take a real look at who we were, we will never become the better selves we strive to be. By bringing in race and sexuality, it reflects a more complete and truer reality. Also, in case you haven't seen the documentary A Secret Love, about two ballplayers from the AAGPBL, All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, that fell in love and were together for over 60 years. I highly recommend it. I appreciate all that you do to help me make sense of and get through each day. That's a nice note.
So, yeah, A League of Their Own is going to be made into a serialized show, and I'm very excited.
Oh, is it?
That.
Oh, that's so interesting. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes.
Cool.
Yes.
Cool.
All right, now we hear from Kevin Doyle. He's a distiller in North Carolina. He says he was laid off early in the pandemic. He goes on to say, so here I am, jobless in August 2020. Despite making more in unemployment during the spring and summer than I had on salary, I've tried twice to get back to work. I have no idea if or when the federal government will ever increase benefits again. I'm terrified there isn't a future for me in an industry that's been deeply hurt by the pandemic recession. But I've got family members supporting me through this, so I know I've got it better than many, many other Americans. That knowledge, however, only points out to me how terrible of a situation this has become and how derelict in their duty so many of our leaders have been. So here's where I answer the make me smart question. As I've observed the partisan stalemate of the last 12 plus years, a common refrain of mine has been they're playing political games with real people's lives. What I know now that I didn't know before is how it feels to have my life really and truly be a part of that political game. People are suffering. These lawmakers' constituents are suffering. But that suffering is being extended because politics is no longer the business of the people. It's now just another team sport.
I think it's tough to disagree with that one. I'm curious about his dating of the partisanship, as it were, the stalemate, to 12 plus years. So the beginning of the Obama administration,
I guess.
You know, things ratcheted up, right, for a lot of reasons then. But, you know, it's been developing for decades.
Yeah. But the family support thing is nice that you have it. But, yeah, it does say a lot about where we are.
And it's and that's the thing that, you know, and look, I've talked about this and we've talked about this and Molly and I have talked about this, about how I'm so gobsmacked that Congress is not able to see the reality, that the economic reality that's in front of them, and instead are hewing to really hard and fast positions, you know.
But the question is, do lawmakers see it? There was a really interesting piece, I want to say it was in the New York Times, looking at sort of the geographic distribution of job losses. And in the neighborhoods and specific communities where a lot of the lawmakers in D.C., for example, and in other places where the lawmakers and the lobbyists and the aides and everybody live are not the same zip codes and neighborhoods that have the highest unemployment. So people may physically not be seeing it in front of their faces in the same way that you do if you live in one of these other neighborhoods.
Which is the thing you said yesterday about evictions. Remember that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? That it's one thing to read about an eviction, and it's another one to, you know, come home to your neighborhood and see people's belongings on the street with them frantically dialing relatives and people they know to help them out.
Yeah.
But yeah.
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 All right. Well, on that uplifting note, that's it for today's show.
Look, it can't always be a good time here. Come on. We try.
Right. So that's it for today's show. Don't forget to subscribe to the newsletter at makemesmart.org and send your questions for tomorrow to makemesmart@marketplace.org. Subject line questions. We will see you or sort of project our voices to you next time. Because we're not going to see them.
No, that's true. I say it every day. I'm like, we'll see you tomorrow. And people always tweet at me and they're like, what?
You're like, no, you won't.
Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Sam Anderson. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. Ben Hethcote is our video producer, and if you're watching this episode on our YouTube channel, that's thanks to me, Ethan Peretz, the video intern. And thanks to writer-producer Erica Phillips. Today's program was engineered by Daniel Ramirez. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. And the executive director of On Demand and senior producer this week is Sitar Nieves.
No, we're done. Music's gonna play out. We'll call it a day.
Okay.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.